Good evening, everyone. I'm your host, Jason Miles, and welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. Quickly, if you're new to the channel, please hit like, please hit subscribe, and don't forget to hit that notification bell so you are alerted whenever we go live, as we are constantly adding new shows, doing cross streams with other channels. You need to hit that notification bell so you're alerted. Just like last Sunday, we did a whole stream for the Kayfabe fundraiser, which worked out great. So I want to, first of all, before I say anything else, thank all of you that donated to the Kayfabe documentary. People donated at the highest tier, and I'm very excited to get these wrestling promos. We're also going to be doing some interviews with some people in the LA area that I think you guys are going to enjoy. Asking them about their definitions of kayfabe and how they feel about the political kayfabe that we're seeing now. Definitely going to throw in some behind the scenes stuff. So thank you guys very much for helping to make this become a reality. And of course, I want to send a massive shout out to all that subscribe on YouTube, Twitch, and of course, the patrons. Guys, help keep TIR afloat and independent. And if you guys would like to have access to the Champagne Rooms past and present, be part of the live virtual audience for the Pascal Robert hosted Mau Mau Hour, join us for movie night, which we'll be doing this Friday. Since my birthday is Saturday, we're doing a movie night Friday. Jeremy and I have been going back and forth on what movies to do. As you know, if you have seen the show before, you know that I am going through a very weird Charles Bronson canon film phase of my life that, to the chagrin of Toussaint, maybe goes along with this mustache kerchief phase of my life. But Jeremy is talking me out of playing a Bronson movie and maybe doing They Live, which also I think would be appropriate since Roddy Piper is the star of that film. Talking about kayfabe, I just actually watched, there's a new Piper biography that I watched the other day that was really good. Check that out, an interesting character, that Roddy Piper. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about him in the Champagne Room, which some of his exploits are definitely not for the regular show. Now that we got that out of the way, let's bring in the TIR crew coming all the way live from Miami, Florida. You may know him as the man of Mau Mau Hour. I know him as my homie, my dog, the Pascal Robert.
Peace and greetings to the audience. Peace and greetings to the chat. Peace and greetings to Jason Miles.
I'm thinking of doing this if I see people talking in the chat. I'm thinking of doing it if Jeremy will allow it. This is all Jeremy has to allow this because he makes movie night happen. I'm thinking about trying to do a double feature. We've done a double feature before. If you remember last time we did a double feature, I effed up and didn't watch the second movie, and I still apologize for that. I had no idea how hot life was in Crackdown. I still apologize for that. I'm not even gonna press the laugh track button because I really do feel bad for that. There were things in that movie I was like, oh, this is offensive in my eyes. But if you guys are down for a double feature, if Jeremy's down for a double feature, I would love to do a They Live. Death Wish 2 is kind of my favorite because that's one with Larry Fishburne in it. Or Death Wish 4, The Crackdown. Two great Bronson films. Speaking of Charles Bronson in New York City, she is the faceless voice of reason. Please welcome M. Toussaint.
Hello, hello. Speaking of Charles Bronson, mm-hmm. What?
M. Boogie, what's happening?
How's it going, Pascal? Jason's feeling cute today in his little shirt.
Wow. Look, I knew John Salazar was going to be on the show today, and I know his shirt game. And I had to match his shirt game. His fitted button-up game, because he is a news professional, is kind of next level. If you're going to have a news professional with next level button up shirt game on your show, go through and find a sensible button up shirt that says, I mean business.
When you wear it, it's a top.
Taco meat here. Taco meat everywhere.
And what is today? It's Taco Tuesday.
Taco Tuesdays.
Get the taco meat out. For Taco Tuesday.
I had tacos today.
You had tacos today? Oh, wow. Did you have vegan tacos?
No, I had Taco Bell.
Oh, God, that hole. Oh, this is going to be a quick show. Pascal will not be joining us in the champagne room tonight because of his Taco Tuesday.
I don't often eat Taco Bell, but
that doesn't make it better.
He's a brave man.
That is a brave man. That's you know, people say, it's a brave choice.
You're from the Bay in Chicago, Jason. I thought you would applaud Taco Bell.
No. I live in Mexico now.
And there's no Taco Bell. There's real Mexican food.
Yes, there's no Taco Bell here, and I'm glad for that, because yeah, that, you know what, we'll save Taco Bell shaming for the champagne room. That is a champagne room conversation if I've ever heard a champagne room conversation. But we have an interesting show today, and Gene Bajelan picked the title because I was having a hard time talking about the title, and I think the title works for Did the Left Forget About the Border. How'd you guys feel about that title?
Good title. We have a short answer and the show is the long answer.
Pascal?
Appropriate question with a very definitive answer.
It seems like a lifetime ago when images of children being separated from their families were seen that shamed many Americans, and it was a signal for many that the Trump regime had to end. While the Trump administration implemented some draconian border policies, the previous Obama administration laid the groundwork. Hell, Clinton started the wall in the 90s. But let's start off with catch and release policy that ended in the early moments of Trump, where immigrants who were caught crossing the border were released until their court date. That ended in 2017. Title 42 during COVID. Not much has changed under the Biden administration. Where is the outrage that was so visible when we saw images of children in cages under tinfoil blankets? To discuss this, we have two people with knowledge of the situation, returning guest and TIR family member, author of one of our favorite books, Borderlines, Dan Mello, and a new face for you guys, John Salazar, journalist at Spectrum News in San Antonio, who's doing some exclusive work at the border. But before we bring them in, Toussaint, you want to play that clip?
Sure. Sorry.
Did you forget to open the
door? No, I do have it.
Okay.
Here.
There you go.
And we're going to play it.
Oh, wait. Toussaint.
What's up?
We got to do the trigger warning. This actually contains some... When I put this together about a year ago, and the show's grown leaps and bounds since we played this, so we thought it was still really relevant to the show today, I actually was able to get some audio of children literally being separated. So Gene Bajelan and Pascal were like, that's pretty brutal. And I really wanted to kind of drive the point home, so just giving you guys a warning that that's on there. So Toussaint, if you will.
Tens of thousands of these workers are brought across the border from Mexico every year. They are given a quickie physical examination at El Centro, then sent to work on big farms in the Imperial Valley, the San Joaquin Valley, the Salinas Valley, the Santa Clara Valley. They work mostly for big farmers who call themselves growers, although they personally grow and harvest only profits. Before World War II, most of the workers in California's fields were domestic agricultural laborers, following the cross every year. During the war, a farm labor shortage developed. Mexican workers were brought in to meet the emergency. Then, the war ended. The emergency was over. But the employers knew a good thing when they saw one. They decided to keep on importing braceros from Mexico under agreements between the U.S. and Mexican governments. Now they prefer Mexican nationals to domestic labor. Not because of some sentimental attachment for Mexican food or Mexican culture or Mexican music, nor because of any real shortage of domestic American labor. It is because a big supply of imported Mexican labor forces down the real wages of American farm workers. It is because an endless supply of destitute contract labor means more profits for the owners of California's rich soil and guarantees them against organization of these workers into unions.
Ever since the United States ceased to be a colony of the British Empire, immigration has been used as a tool of the ruling class to regulate labor. While xenophobic fears may ignite passionate debate, capitalism is the driving factor in the bipartisan draconian immigration legislation we see to this day. We'll discuss capitalism's role in the United States southern border policy and more. This is Revolution.
I'm very pleased that you could all be here today. I know how busy you've been with events leading up to Tuesday's election, and I want to congratulate all of you in the House of Representatives who've just been reelected. This bill, the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986 that I'll sign in a few minutes, is the most comprehensive reform of our immigration laws since 1952. It's the product of one of the longest and most difficult legislative undertakings in the last three Congresses. Further, it's an excellent example of a truly successful bipartisan effort.
Yeah, that's what it says.
Guatemala.
No llores. Vas a llegar con... Mira, ella te va a explicar y te va a ayudar. ¿Cierto, consulado?
Te va a pasar con su consulado.
El papá.
All right. Are you guys ready to have a conversation? Coming all the way live from North Carolina, he is the author of Borderlines and TIR family member, Dan Mello.
Hey, guys.
My Mello, my Dan.
Excited to be back on. It's been I feel forgotten about, Jason. It's been too long.
This is the Dan.
And for the first time on the show, this is someone I met. I saw that people were playing a TIR drinking game. They'd say, when are they going to mention music? And I met this guy playing live in Marfa, Texas. So John Salazar is a Spectrum News San Antonio original. After 4 years of working at Spectrum News Austin, John came to San Antonio in 2014 to help launch the news station. The Alamo City has been home to him ever since. Before that, John worked as a broadcast news photojournalist. The TV veteran brings more than two decades of experience to the news team, and he's been doing some amazing work at the southern border in Texas. Please welcome my friend, John Salazar.
Hey, Jason, I just want to let you know that I didn't wear my blouse. I wore my regular black t-shirt to the show. I didn't want to get singled out or punked or anything, so I just kind of came as myself, and this is me. So thanks for the invitation.
Hey, thank you both for coming on the show. I'm really glad to get you guys on. I haven't seen too much coverage about the southern border. I almost feel like for a lot of people, it's just not an in vogue cause now that they don't have to hear about children in cages anymore. And I think that's one of the few things the Biden administration tried to deal with was unaccompanied minors, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's a mess. The border's been a mess since 2018 when President Trump at the time basically shut down the southern border and broke the fragile and hobbled asylum process that we had in place. And you know, the Biden administration has tried to reassemble it, and they've not done very well. There are tens of thousands of asylum seekers and migrants just on the other side of the border, looking for, you know, immigration relief, as they say. So it's a mess. Billions of dollars are pumped into, you know, the immigration industry, which it's now become. And I've told my bosses, I've told my newsroom, since I study it down on the border, this thing is not going away, because it is a money-making machine, regardless of the administration who's in power.
Pascal?
The thing that I find fascinating about this is that the only political faction of the country that seems to be effectively weaponizing what's happening at the border are the conservatives, because they're the only one that's talking about it, and they've tried to lay it out as a demonstration of the incompetence of the Biden administration. What's really interesting is that what our guest just exposed to us is that much of the origins of this problem really go back to the Trump administration. Can we get a timeline as to exactly how we got here with the border, and who are the real culprits behind this? Or is this basically just both sides are like, there's no good guy in this issue at all?
Right. I mean, it all started in 1776 when they, you know, passed the no, but, you know, just right. Like, I think the makings of the modern, you know, iteration of the current border crisis do have a lot to do with Trump, right? And it's not just, you know, the ramping up of enforcement at the borders. It's also doing things like shutting down refugee processing centers abroad so that it's harder and harder to process people, you know, abroad and have them brought here. You know, obviously COVID also just did some really weird displacing kind of shit throughout Central America. Anyway, to like put some figures on it, right? So, you know, you have an increase in the number of folks over the last few years that have been coming. It's now up to, I think the latest number I saw is about 1,000 people a day are coming up through Central America, which is roughly the amount of people that the administration is turning back at the border every single day, right? But which is nothing to say, of course, that the already massive amount of people that have been sitting outside of the border basically since the Trump administration.
Jesus.
To John's point, you know, on the hobbled asylum system, it's like the backlogs were already terrible, right? So it's not just like a front end bottleneck, it's also a back end bottleneck. So now the average immigration case in immigration court takes roughly 4 to 5 years to be seen through end to end. So, you know, it's like even if you were to give the system, you know, like the some credibility and legitimacy in some meaningful way in terms of actually hearing people and actually processing claims, is not doing it in a way that's going to get through all of the people that are piling up on the other side, right? And so to loop it all back to what Pascal was saying, so now you have conservatives, right, red states in particular, who are capitalizing on this. You know, you have in Pascal's backyard, right, Florida just passed one of the most like comprehensive anti-immigrant bills that makes it a felony to traffic people by bringing an undocumented person into the state, collecting DNA off of migrants who are on ICE holds, all kinds of stuff, right? Like Texas, you know, and the buoys and shit, all these different folks sending National Guard to the border. They're all making a lot of great hay of it. Of course, you know, it doesn't, you don't even have to be a historian at this point to look at how deterrence has never actually done any kind of meaningful deterring, because the socioeconomic global capitalist push factors are bringing people not just from Central America anymore. We were actually talking before the show how there are Russians, Ukrainians, Afghans, folks from, you know, Haiti, from the Caribbean, Africa. It's like, and folks are actually making those treks from, you know, the other side of the world to Mexico to try to make land entries at the border.
Jesus. Go ahead, Pascal. I'm sorry.
There was an argument that I found being made by many on the right as well that argued that simply because Biden won the election It gave immigrants the belief that immigration would be eased, and as a result, it increased the number of migrants who are trying to flow into the country. Is that pure speculation and hogwash, or was there any truth to that?
Yeah, I'm going to be myself right now, since I'm not, you know, broadcasting live on our television station, but it's complete horseshit. Mm. And, you know, the Republicans are winning the talking points with whatever issue they've got at hand. They're so convincing, whether it's supporting Trump, you know, through the latest indictment, or making it seem like these mothers and children and elderly folks that are, you know, looking for economic relief coming in from Venezuela, as if, you know, they're murderers and rapists, and, you know, carrying, you know, the bundles of, you know, of marijuana on their back. And that's just not the case. So the Republicans highly politicize this game. And, you know, Texas right now, Pascal, I've got to tell you, if you want to pay attention to immigration, pay attention to what's happening in Texas, because we are ground zero, more than Arizona, more than California when it comes to politics. Over the last two legislative sessions here in Texas, Governor Abbott has been able to finance his Operation Lone Star border security measures to the tune of $10 billion. Oof. Think about that. This is a state paying $10 billion for their own border security. We're talking, you know, extra DPS troopers. We're talking the National Guard. We're talking fencing. We're talking wires in the river. We're talking buoys that are doing nothing. They're tied up in litigation right now. So the Republicans are winning the talking points when it comes to border security, keeping people safe in America. And the Democrats have done a terrible job at managing the asylum process. They have tried. I have witnessed them try with policies. And what they're doing now with a lot of the asylum seekers is they're using an application with their phone, CBP-1. They show up to the border. They download the app. They try to make an appointment. And, you know, they only allow so many appointments in per day. And then once they're in the country under, you know, Biden's, you know, new policies to offer immigration relief, a lot of these people are let into the country without permission to work. So of course they're going to work in the dark. Of course they're going to take the jobs that nobody wants. They're going to mow lawns. They're going to work in kitchens. You know, they're going to clean for not even minimum wage. You know, they're going to take whatever job they can take in construction, because the Biden administration is not giving them that permission slip when they're allowed to be in the country to actually work. And I talk to the migrants because I follow them through the process, and they're frustrated. Like, can you find me an attorney so I can get permission to work in the country? I'm like, you know, you're going to have to work your local resources. I mean, I'm just a journalist covering the events, but nobody's held the Biden administration accountable for why are you not giving these people permission to work in the country if this is what Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said was going to happen back in December when they were going to start letting these people in. Why don't you give them permission to work? And so there we have it. It's a money-making machine. People are still working for next to nothing just to put food on the table. It's a slow process to get in. They're fleeing economic disparity, conflict, authoritarian rule, you know, climate change, and the list goes on. One thing that I want to say that I have to tell everybody, people that are not paying attention, that's very important in this equation. Right now, we're witnessing the greatest immigration flow on the face of the world in all of human history. Mm. I mean, this is historical in biblical terms, as they say, and more people are looking for relief, and it's not going to get any better anytime soon. As we see the fire that's burning up Hawaii, hello, we're a mess. So none of this is going to slow down. Policies are bad. Human beings like you and I and everybody listening to us talk about this issue, it's not going to get better for any one of us.
You mentioned something that I really want to highlight, because I saw a news coverage of this, and I had to read an article about it, that was so disturbing that it really sent a chill up my spine. You talked about buoys. And I didn't really understand the vile nature of these things. that I think it's on the Texas, in the, one of the rivers on the Texas border.
Yeah.
Is that one of the things that Texas has done is that they have put these buoys in the water that have blades that slice off the limbs of migrants if they get caught in the buoys. And there have been cases of people dying and being cut up in these buoys as a result of their dispatch in this service. Can you guys talk about that?
Yeah, let me clarify the buoys and just focus on that, because that's what I've been covering extensively the last 2 months. Eagle Pass, Texas, do a quick Google search, look up Eagle Pass, Texas, look up DPS, look up buoys, and there'll be a collection of stories that pop up in regards to what's happening in Eagle Pass. So the city of Eagle Pass basically gave the Texas Department of Public Safety a green light to take over this park that's down on the banks of the Rio Grande 2 months ago. They put pressure on the local mayor. The mayor bended, basically signed an affidavit to release public land to the state of Texas, basically making public land private land for DPS and Governor Abbott to do with that park as they please. That right there is tied up in litigation right now. This has only come about in the last 2 months. So once they got permission to take over this park, Abbott ordered the buoys. They put canisters up on the banks of the Rio Grande so people couldn't fish anymore. Families were not allowed to go down and enjoy the green space as they had for generations. It's a hostile takeover, as I had reported by the state of Texas, but the mayor did sign an affidavit allowing them to do that. They pull those buoys in. They're just shy of 1,000 feet. They're large. And in the middle of those, the balls, there is a separation point where there is a blade that goes around there, right? And in between every one of those balls, the blade is in there. You know, and you can only look at that and kind of envision the creator, the innovator's mindset of why he's creating these buoys, right? These buoys have gotten so much attention in Texas and so much press in Texas. And, you know, the local people there in Eagle Pass have been pushing back to try to, you know, renege that that affidavit that gave Abbott permission to be there. But the buoys are still in place. The Department of Justice early last week filed a lawsuit against the state of Texas and Governor Greg Abbott. Next Tuesday in federal court in Austin, Texas, I'm driving up there to cover the first hearing of that. But the Department of Justice basically is demanding for those buoys to be pulled out of the water. They're citing international treaties which have been violated. They're talking about human rights issues. And Abbott didn't ask anybody permission to put those buoys in the water. Mexico is upset. There were some Mexican diplomats that came into the United States last week to talk about this very issue. There was the very first image of a human body, a migrant, floating parallel to those buoys. And there was another body of a young child found not far from those buoys. There have been images of migrants cut up by the wire, not the buoys, cut up by the wire, the Constantine wire, the military wire, the war wire that Abbott has put in the waters of the Rio Grande, right? And if we're not paying attention to this today, all of us are letting our country get away from us. So I'm just one little guy reporting for Texas. Sometimes New York picks up my stuff. Sometimes LA picks up my stuff. But they're so disconnected from the reality that's happening here in Texas that it's just it makes a splash and they forget about it and they go on and cover something else. But this is serious business that's happening down in Texas. And Governor Abbott right now is getting his way. It's dangerous.
Let me ask, Dan, maybe you can help me with this a little bit. Donald Trump had declared a state of emergency with the border crisis when he gets into office. And that allowed him to access funds to, you know, kind of do what he pleased. with border policy as well. What's going on currently with that state of emergency? Are we still in a, quote, state of emergency at the border?
As far as I know, and John can correct me, I think that the actual, like, state of emergency at the federal level has ended, right? And they, you know, after a lot of back and forth, they finally have pulled back on Title 42, but then immediately implemented, you know, a new, as John was talking about, the CBP One app and requiring asylees. Mm-hmm. Here's the other crazy thing that's happening is that there's new rules in place around asylum that require people to apply for asylum somewhere else before they get to the States, or they're presumptively denied asylum here in the U.S., right? Yeah. So that means that, well, where else are most people going to go? Mexico. You think our asylum system isn't doing so hot right now? Check out Mexico's, right? So anyway, and that's not a knock on Mexico. It's just like, it wasn't in a great spot, not designed to handle this level of people. There's a whole nother, you know, wave of sort of crisis there. And I guess, like, John's point's, like, you know, again, like, it's just on its own, right, is a total freak out kind of thing. But what's equally, like, I guess, like, alarming sort of downhill from all of that is that so much, not just at the federal level, but, like, you know, organizations like the one I work for, or, you know, just all of the standard ones that would try to combat these kind of things in the courts, are increasingly spending more and more and more resources just trying to get crazy shit like this to not be a thing, right? Let alone progressing, you know, any kind of meaningful change to the system, or, you know, again, just fighting for, like, again, other basic things that were a problem well before now. So there's tons of other resources that are just being spent on deciding whether or not Texas can sue the government, whether or not Texas can put buoys in the water, whether or not Florida is going to be able to keep, you know, like, rolling out these kinds of anti-immigrant laws. So much money, again, what John was talking about, like, money is getting dumped into this problem, but around the fringes of the problem. So, you know, that $10 billion figure has to be way, way, way higher when you start to consider all the collateral consequences that come from Abbott, you know, just throwing buoys in the water to be a shithead. The other thing, like, is that long term, right, like, it also is really just cementing this shitty status quo. So because we're having all of these esoteric fights about what Texas can and can't do, or Florida, or, you know, any of the other number states who are trying to take measures into their own hands, so to speak, it ultimately just re-cements the fact. So, like, when Biden finally, like, you know, pulled back on Title 42, it was like, oh my God, we're going back to, you know, the way things were before. It's like, well, the way things were before was terrible, right? This was just went from awful to terrible. That's not an improvement. But those are, so anyway, all that to say is that it's like, those are the kinds of problems then that it's like, we're moving that whole window of struggle to something like, do we really have to fight as a country that, like, well, we shouldn't have buoys with saws on them in the water? Like, that's where we're at.
Right.
And I think that, like, I, you know, to go also to just go back to, like, the premise of the show, I think that in a way, like, it's not that they've forgotten, it's just that they've buried their heads in the sand on this one. Like, they just rather not know about it. Right. Because it's too big of a problem.
Is it too confusing too, Dan? Because we tend to look at things, especially because in this internet space, we talk about atomization, but the one kind of conversation that is the glue for a lot of shows are federal discussions.
Yeah.
And when we talk about Texas, I mean, we've said it before on this show several times, this Supreme Court is giving more and more power to states.
Right.
So these governors can now act like little presidents more so than they could even beforehand. That's so right. when you look at Texas, right? It feels like the buoys.
It's exactly what he's doing. He's testing his powers, and you know, we've got so much money sitting in the state coffers that it means nothing to him to go ahead and challenge whatever the Biden administration policies might be and send it up to the Supreme Court to find out what may stick. And that's exactly correct, Jason.
Does it feel like to you that even the buoys, to some extent, are part of, I mean, they pose a real problem? Again, for those that don't know, I do live in Mexico, maybe about 40 or so minutes from the border. And the border here is different than where John is, as far as a flowing of people. But there's definitely quite a few people that are not from Latin America coming in the country. We were talking before, I met a Russian man today. There's definitely a good amount of Haitian. There's a Haitian community in Tijuana, yeah. From all of the Haitian migrants that got kind of stuck as well. Does it feel like they're using these things as part of a preemptive culture war battle for the 2024 election?
It's a good question. You know, it's a really good question. I think with the buoys exclusively, I think Governor Abbott is challenging, he's testing his state powers. And those buoys only cost Texas, a taxpayer, only cost us $1 million for 1,000 feet of buoys, right?
Jesus.
It's a relatively cheap investment for a wealthy rich state. So I'm thinking, Abbott probably sitting around, let's send these in the water and see if we can be allowed to let these stay in the name of border security, because the Biden administration is doing a terrible job of doing it. So we have to protect our own sovereignty under what the Texas Constitution says. So I think this is a cheap investment for him to test his powers, to see if the Supreme Court will give him immigration enforcement rules, an immigration enforcement power moving forward. Is it a test run for 2024 with the question that you asked? Man, I'd hope not, but I hope that he's just testing state powers. I want to clarify, there's somebody in the chat had asked about, is there a state of emergency in Texas? That's a great question. And the reason that Governor Abbott is able to run his Operation Lone Star border security measures is because he issued a state of emergency as it relates to immigration about 2 years ago. And that gives him a lot of power and a lot of money, a lot of resources to do what he wants to until local communities push back. Thank goodness for the citizens of Eagle Pass. They are pushing back and they're fighting. There's a couple of lawsuits there. But it's a big mountain to climb. You got to remember that Texas is the ninth largest economy on the face of the planet. We've got as much money as Vladimir Putin does. We just don't have, the nuclear arsenal that he's got.
But thank goodness.
Thank goodness. Right? Thank goodness. Never mind the buoys.
Yeah. That's the last thing Texas needs.
So he's got a lot of money, and he wants to test his powers, I think.
You know what's really interesting about this analysis that we're going through here that Jason has started about how the red states, the kind of right-wing states, as a result of the Supreme Court and the way in which our politics are moving, have become powered to have not only super legislatures, but super governors. I'm thinking as a Floridian, I say that with such dismay.
That hurt me listening to it. It hurt my soul hearing you say that.
That the prototype for this, for me, is like DeSantis, because Abbott is horrible, but it's like, I don't believe this strategy is accidental. I think that there is a Republican strategy of returning back to the state power. I mean, this goes back to the 60s with, what's his name, who ran from Arizona. States' rights has been a mantra of the reactionary right, since the Civil War in this country. But the point I'm saying is that delegitimizing federal power and moving back to state control has been a mantra of the reactionary right for many, many years.
Yeah.
And after Trump, who has never really struck me as someone who can ideologically implement a long-term vision for his agenda that it would have impact, it's interesting how the states were the ones to take that opening of Trumpism and really put down the work to implement that kind of turning back the clock.
Yeah.
Abbott, DeSantis, and you're seeing this. And there's no effective pushback. Like, there is no... I was having a conversation with a friend of mine, a mentor of mine, Janice Graham, friend of the show. And she's saying, there's... Why isn't there a federal legal challenge to what's going on in Florida and Texas? Why aren't the marching organizations, whether they be nonprofits or movement organizations within the coterie of the Democratic Party, why aren't they creating a movement against the sycophants of the right wing? And I said, you know, I don't have an answer. This did. I mean, I think that part of the problem is that the Democratic Party is arguing from a position of weakness.
Yes.
No one trusts the party on a national level, frankly. And they can't, it seems that they can't marshal the national outrage outside of their true loyalists to challenge what's going on. Because so many independents now are flirting with elements of Trumpism because they just don't trust the Democratic Party.
We're living in the Bronson Age, and, you know, Trump, you know, ran on a campaign of vengeance. And to some degree, a lot of people got into Bernie Sanders on that same kind of campaign of some sort of vengeance. And I'm going to get mine, you know, and that's a whole different conversation. But does immigration kind of fall under that same campaign? Because, you know, I think a lot of what we're seeing with like tough on crime stories in the news. I mean, John, you work in news. I feel like three years ago, maybe even 5 years ago. When did the border thing really take off? Which was 2017? So maybe 2017, 2018, we care about the border. I remember people going down to El Paso in droves to give blankets to the kids. And you know, this had to stop. You know, people really gave a damn for a minute. And then you have, you know, 2020, the shelter in place. You have this George Floyd moment where kind of the country's on fire for a bit. And it felt like there was almost a Democratic victory lap,
right?
In a way, but now you're seeing the kind of pushback on that victory lap, which is, well, we're going to give you guys tough on crime news, and you're going to get fed ad nauseum why all these blue cities are failures: San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York. You know, New York elects Eric Adams, who comes in tough on crime, wants to institute stop and frisk again. London Breed in San Francisco is talking tough on crime stuff. So they even out the DA, Chase Aboudin. He gets blamed for homelessness, which is odd. I've never seen a DA get blamed for homelessness and crime. Yeah. It seems like that strategy for them is working. Are they able to put immigration in that same bag as crime?
Yeah, they've added immigration to that boogeyman list. Mm-hmm. Spectrum News does a really good job. You know, I wouldn't call them mainstream media, but, you know, they are a massive media conglomerate. But we do local community news, things that should be important to the average person. Mm-hmm. They did a research study in October, November, and the second most important thing to all Texans was immigration. You know, they wanted a fix. They wanted something done. Not necessarily, you know, build a wall, throw up fencing, more along the lines of, you know, people must, you know, do something, or, you know, Abbott's going to get away with it. So here we got the, you know, the tough on crime, you know, talking points. Immigration is now at the top of the list. It's working out for DeSantis in California. It's working out for Abbott.
Florida.
In Florida, my bad. In Florida, working out for Abbott here in Texas and a handful of other conservative states. Arizona seems to be kind of looking purple these days. They start to look red, but then they start to look purple again, but they're kind of in the middle trying to find their identity, looking for a conscience. Colorado's flat out gone to the left, you know, as far as mainstream politics are concerned. And then Georgia is starting to show a little bit of common sense. It does seem, you know, leaning over in the other direction away from some of that hardcore right-wing rhetoric that carries the GOP party, as we're now, you know, witnessing with the indictments that just came out of Atlanta yesterday. Mm-hmm. But yes, immigration is up there as a boogeyman for a lot of people, you know, who vote GOP, very much so, like it is, you know, tough on crime.
Yeah, but things that what's interesting about what Jason just said, I think that we will really want to frame it even being more dangerous, is that he's saying that even Democrats are willing to float anti-immigrant talking points along with anti-crime sentiment as a blowback to the excesses of the progressive socialists. I saw Eric Adams using anti-socialist talking points in a speech.
Did you guys see, did Pascal, I don't know if you saw this, I was talking about this with our good friend Cedric Johnson, professor and author in the city of Chicago, and there was a news story in Chicago where the city was going to pay for a building to house immigrants seeking asylum. Did you guys see this? Did you see this, Dan? And so the black citizens, because of the framing, and it wasn't that much money, the black citizens were protesting these Latin people getting asylum. And it's just been a nightmare. Because, like, look, we have these hotels, and we'll commandeer this hotel and, you know, pay for it. I think it was a hotel. I don't think it was they didn't build anything new. And we're going to give asylum. And it's just been a nightmare. Yeah. For Chicago.
To tack onto that, just it's like, so there's very recent Gallup polling that talks about, like, you know, like how the respective sort of groups, you know, Republicans and Democrats, perceive immigrants both internally and then those at the border. And of course, like, the Republicans by and large, like, don't give a shit about either, right? And either think that they're a massive problem and need to go away, or at best are indifferent to them. But the really interesting number to me is that, like, even amongst Democrats, right, there's a lot more sympathy for folks on the other side of the border right now and everything that's going on than there are for established but undocumented people in the country, right? And so, again, I think, you know, to your point, it's like, yes, this is such a winning political issue for conservatives right now, because deterrence, like, even though it doesn't work, we have plenty of history at this point in the political economy that shows that it doesn't work. Hence the numbers that we have right now, right? It doesn't matter, right? It just doesn't, because as long as you're seen as tough, that's all that matters. That's all that counts. And so, again, it is striking to me that it's like, not only do the Dems, like, as a party, not really have a plan and don't seem to care a whole lot about actually trying to remedy, you know, some of the underlying drive factors that bring people here, but even as just like a society, as a political group, Democrats don't give a shit about the people that they live next door to who are undocumented, even relative to those that are suffering. So again, it goes back to, like, well, it makes the whole thing a moral issue rather than a political one.
Toussaint, do you want to add anything? You've been rather quiet.
Sure. Well, One of the things that I find disturbing in this situation is some of the framing around sanctuary cities. Some of the conservative framing is moving towards considering the behavior of sanctuary cities as open borders. It's already bad enough that they're shipping, you know, people from Texas, from Florida, to New York, to New Jersey, to Chicago.
California. But
they're also framing it as an open borders issue, and the Democrats are going to run from that for sure.
It's Tucson. It's a, that issue. I was like, I was the first broadcast journalist to follow one of the buses that Abbott had shipped out of here all the way to DC last year. Got behind the bus loaded with migrants who had permission to be in the country, funded by the Texas taxpayer. And, you know, sanctuary cities, it's a catch 22, damned if you do, damned if you don't, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you want to let people come and live in peace until they can get their immigration issue resolved. But in the meantime, you know, you've got Governor Abbott and DeSantis from Florida that are just demonizing these cities. And Abbott is, you know, with his Operation Lone Star, is paying for these buses to, you know, legally give these people a bus rides to LA, New York, Chicago, you know, DC, Denver, any city they consider to be, you know, migrant friendly, but really it shouldn't be migrant friendly. It should be like, you know, human friendly, you know, it should be
right.
You know, a compassionate city. Yes. We won't like target you. We'll leave you the fuck alone and let you, you know, have a job and raise your family instead of being demonizing these poor folks. So yeah, damned if you do, damned if you don't with the sanctuary city. And, you know, the mayor out of New York, I mean, Abbott sent so many migrants up there. He created a humanitarian situation by doing that. I mean, he flooded New York City. They could only take in so much before they had to go, whoa, this is a problem. Well, it was a problem created by Texas, not a problem created by normal immigration flow.
That's an interesting point. I mean, Pascal, as a New Yorker and a child of immigrants, how do you feel about that situation in Texas?
Well, I definitely see.
It feels like, before I let you go, it feels like, again, this has been the greatest strategy because abortion was such a huge loser for these states across the board. They just can't win because everybody, you know, doesn't want their child to have to go back to the stone ages of hangers in private. So how do you see how A, Adams is trying to handle this, and B, how do you see this as a strategy that seems to be a successful strategy for Republicans, Pascal?
It's a brilliant strategy for red state Republicans because it paints the Republicans as the only party that has the cojones to show these libs what it's like to live with all this immigration. In other words, it's like, you know, we're the party of the real men. We got to show these libs with their weak talk what are the consequences of these policies. It's actually almost kind of like political bullying. So it works well for the psyche of the Republican Party, but it's a nightmare for left or liberal states. Well, not even liberal states, for Democratic states, because we know these states aren't left. These are corporate Democrat-run states. It's a nightmare for them because they can't juxtapose their position, their prior positions on immigration, on being sanctuary cities or sanctuary states or locations, with what they have to do to deal with these new migrants now, because they don't fit into the numerical equation of what their normal flow of immigration would be. So it's a very effective quandary that the right-wing states have dropped on Democratic run municipalities. And the Democratic state cities are not going to be able to effectively deal with it.
Yeah, you're right. You did it. You said it. That's 100% right there.
Toussaint, you want to read this super chat?
Sure do. This is from JB.
Thank you, JB.
Was the whole concept of sanctuary city as it came to prominence during the Trump administration really just a cheap anti-Trump political trick by Dem mayors?
It felt like it. It felt like it. I mean, the strategy against Trump really didn't fall, in my opinion, too far away from the basket of deplorables rhetoric that you got from Hillary in her campaign speech. And sanctuary cities, you know, while helpful, right? I'm from a sanctuary area, the Bay Area. But, you know, as Pascal so eloquently described, they're not ready to handle that backlash. All the backlash that's happening right now, all the news that I'm reading about right now is much in the favor of the right and the GOP. The only thing that they have, they just can't win is the abortion conversation. And that's kind of where people are going back to. I mean, even Gavin Newsom's trying to get a new constitutional amendment about gun safety, because that's constantly going to be an issue and a bit of a sticky one, because even the most, you know, John and Dan both live in, I think, open carry areas. Even the most, you know, righteous gun dude, when something happens, the first thing they say is, you know, we need tougher laws on these criminals that go and get guns and you know, and this bill, I think, plays into that rhetoric. And because it's has the veneer of liberalism with Gavin Newsom being behind it, I could see a lot of Dems and people that call themselves liberals being behind, you know, universal gun checks doesn't really seem like such a bad thing in the grand scheme of things. I mean, what was the song about? Try that in a small town. You know, sadly, Uvalde was a very small town and horrible tragedy happened there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Same thing with Parkland, Florida. I mean, there was a security guard that was armed that was afraid to go inside. It's frightening. Like, I don't know if people have ever owned guns watching the show or actually shot people. That's a scary thing. We had Mac on the show talking about war crimes in Afghanistan. He spent years in Afghanistan, and the things he had to do still haunt him to this day.
Yeah.
So it's not easy to pull out a gun and shoot somebody. As much as we'd like to think so. I mean, you ever see shootouts? It's always like this.
Violence is everywhere.
It is. That's why we're in the Bronze Age, I'm telling you. I'm going to finish that paper. Don't you worry.
The Bronze Age.
Dan Mello says I should play.
I will publish it.
I was going to ask you about that. Before we go, we do have to pitch your new thing. Did you know Mike Watson beforehand, or did you know him from Zero Books? Like, how do you?
I met Mike Watson through Zero, you know, and some of the fallout of it changing hands, and we just got to chatting, and so thanks for letting me just take a quick moment. So Mike Watson and I of Meming Mark Fisher fame are launching a small independent press. We are calling ourselves Revol. We are taking submissions right now. So if folks have a short book in them, I'm looking at you, Pascal. I'm looking at you, John. Anybody? please drop us a line. We've been working on this for about a year now. So we've sort of got a lot of the stuff lined up and ready to go. And we're excited to start working with people. We've already had some interest and are excited about with some of the folks that we're talking about and some of the titles that we're going to put out, but really hoping to just orient publishing, left publishing back around authors and start there and go forward.
It's called Revolt.
Revol. R-E-V-O-L.
Gotcha.
I'm all about it because I like Mike Watson. Mike Watson's also been on TIR. Because he lives in Europe, it's also harder to get him on the show. But another guy I'd love to have back. Uh-oh, we have a link. So wherever you're watching or listening to the show, there will be a link in the description. There's definitely going to be a link in the chat. Toussaint and I will probably leave a link in the comments once the show is done to Revol Press. And yes, I do have a book in the works, Dan. The finished script. It's a mini book. It would be very short. Very short. I don't know if you guys are into the short stuff.
We are. So, okay. By all means.
Yeah, it's definitely short. It's the script for Kayfabe. We're going to edit it down to a book. So, so I'm excited for that. John, yes. Where can our listeners find you?
Well, you know, people get to see the like the cleaned up, homogenized John Salazar in Spectrum News. You know, one of the comments, I've been trying to read the comments. I find this fascinating. I didn't realize this would be a live show. It doesn't bother me. My bosses let me be me. I do have to clean it up on air. But one of the comments was, I wouldn't expect somebody to say something nice about Spectrum, right? I'm fair. I've quit terrible news organizations. I've told news directors to go fuck themselves when they wanted me to, you know, do stuff that was fringing over in the direction of right-wing media. I'm like, fuck that, man. It's not who I am. Like, go fuck yourself. And I'd walk out and go get another job, you know, because somebody would understand my work. But Spectrum lets me be me to the best of my ability. They let me talk to the migrants. They let me cover it, and they realize that I'm doing good. So where can you find me? Do a simple search. Spectrum News Texas, John Salazar. I'm on Instagram, John Anthony, John Anthony, John Anthony. Find me there. I'm buddies with Jason. Definitely. And I'm also on Facebook, John Anthony Salazar. And I try to put a few more things out there to show my personality. But, I am a professional. I do have to maintain ethics on a venue like this, which I think is important for the foundation of democracy and to keep our light alive as a nation. People must come together, sit around the fireplace and have conversations and be critical and ask questions and lay out, anecdotes of what we believe could make our country better. And right now it does appear that we're in a fucking mess. So we got to come together. People have to vote and, keep the faith or, we're all going to fucking die sooner than later. So, and I want to live because we only get one chance at this. And then we just like disappear and black out and we're done.
It's funny you say that because I live in Mexico now and my neighbor that lives below me. Can you hear me?
I'm jealous.
you got to come visit, brother.
I will. I promise.
He took me out to dinner and we were talking and he says, he's asking me if I play golf. I'm like, nah, dude, I don't play. He goes, I want you to come play golf. He goes, because I play with all these right wing guys. He goes, I'm not a Trump fan. He's like, are you a Trump fan? I'm like, no, I'm not a Trump fan. And so he goes, he had asked one of his right wing lawyer friends. He goes, this guy's a lawyer. He goes, would you believe this guy's a lawyer? And he asked me, he goes, why do you like Trump? And the guy said, because Trump came in like John Wayne with guns blazing. To Pascal's point earlier about, the way the right wing is positioning themselves. And I found that kind of fascinating that someone still feels that way about someone like Donald Trump, because it's all just, bullshit image.
There's a whole psyche about the Republican Party that is rooted in notions of masculine redemption. Discourse, it's in the symbolism, it's in the language, everything from save the patriarchy, which I've actually heard Bannon say with his own mouth. They're coming for the patriarchy, which is something we've had for 6,000 years, about feminists, about the traditional role of the family. So regardless of what you think about that, but what I'm trying to say, Candace Owens is always talking about, we need strong men, masculine. There is a belief that is replete within the minds of Republicans and conservatives that the function of everyone on the left, from whatever strain, whether it be Democrats to the far left, is to undermine not only traditional family values, but particularly traditional notions of masculinity. And it's the job of the right to protect them. And they congregate around political figures that they feel demonstrate that masculinity. And it is no question that that's part of the motivation behind the affection for Trump. That he comes off like a man who can say whatever he wants.
Yeah, and I agree with you in the way I see it, going back to the roots of our country, it's not just, the head of the household, it's the head of the household who's actually white, who wants to be in command and wants to be in control, and he's their savior, and they say that and they wear that on, on their shirts, and it is about, white man's rule. I can say that. I believe it. I study politics. This is about keeping, the flame of the Confederacy alive. I don't know how many 150 years after the goddamn fucking revolution, like the motherfuckers won't let it go, but they're still fighting it. There are country clubs that brown and black people and Jews couldn't be a part of it. They just lifted those rules not that long ago, going back to civil rights. So this is when Trump came in, guns a-blazing like John Wayne, they're like, now we can start to take our country back. And that's what I'm witnessing. That's what I'm seeing. Women's rights are whittling away. We're going to get to a place to where, brown people are having to sit in the back of a goddamn restaurant because white people want to sit at the front. I mean, who knows, right? Our rights are going away. So
I'm sure there's someone's restaurant in Texas like that. It's gotta be like one. Inviter, Texas. There's like maybe like one restaurant inviter.
You heard of it.
The Whataburger inviter. He's walking. Sorry, sir. Why are you entering this in front?
Wrong color, sir.
Yes. The sun has not set yet, so we're going to give you 15 minutes to get.
I mean, you're handsome in shirt, and your shirt looks great. You have nice chest hair, but Mr. Miles, you're going to have to leave
now. Sorry, sir. You just sorry. We have an image to uphold. And we're sun downtown still. Just kidding. But I don't know how many people are watching Inviter, Texas. But if you are, please send me an email. Looking at This Is Revolution podcast. And I want to hear everything. Everything. John, thank you for hanging out with us. Dan, thank you for hanging out with us. Pascal, are you coming to the champagne room or are you going to call it an evening?
I'll come in.
You're going to come in for a little bit? Since it's hip hop's 50th birthday, I did my due diligence and found some hip hop that we can listen to.
And not cringe. And not cringe.
Oh yeah, it's gonna make you make that face that you make at me when I show you something that makes you uncomfortable.
Great.
No,
I'm here for it. Wonderful way. That's what I'm here for.
You know, Dan loves when Jason does things in the champagne room that makes me profoundly uncomfortable. He loves
it. It's bad. I found stuff, and maybe again, you know, Steve makes fun of me, one of the viewers of the show, because I am old. I will be 46 Saturday. So I don't know if these are new songs or not. They're new to me. I feel like they're new to many of you guys. I don't know if I was the first person that you guys heard the Eating People's Behind song. I don't want to say the whole words. But I found something that I think is crazier than that. So I'm excited to play those things for Pascal.
Jason, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed all the listeners. It looks like you've got a very active audience.
Yes.
You know, your co-hosts here, you know, quite informed and very hip and smart and articulate. And what an honor. And I really appreciate it, man.
No, John, real talk. Thank you for coming on, brother. I've been watching what you've been doing. I don't comment on it a lot because I don't want you to get in trouble.
No, you're okay. You're okay.
Don't challenge him, John. Don't invite him. Find a
way. I will say this. I will say this, John, we'll sign off. We're looking to come to Austin. We wanted to come this year, but it looks like maybe next year we'll be doing a live show like this in the Austin area.
Really?
Yep.
Well, I think you should invite me back in soon.
Yeah.
I do really want to help break down Texas politics for you.
Oh, well, we're doing a Texas politics show next week.
Yeah.
So if you got time, I the door is always open for a friend, man.
Thanks, brother. I appreciate it.
So we will see you guys in the champagne room. I believe I effed up and didn't put the link up. So viewers, give me 5-10 minutes, put the link up. And did we send it to you, Dan, already, the link for the champagne room?
Yeah, I'm good.
Okay. Hey, Dan, good night, all. And as we say on TIR, we are
out.